I'm very happy to welcome Joanna Brooks. She is chair of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at San Diego State University. She is author of the new memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl, and tonight she will be giving a lecture called Mormonism, Demystified, Globalized, Decolonized. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, so happy to be here. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a really fascinating memoir in which you describe growing up in Southern California as a Mormon girl and the sense of beauty, safety, magic, and belonging are so powerful.
Mormonism is a faith that justly wins people's entire lives because it is still one of America's finest living experiments of communalism. I mean, in our congregations, I come from a multi-generational Mormon family. I have ancestors who crossed the plains as Mormon pioneers in the 19th century. I was raised feeling this deep historical connection to the faith, but also a living community, you know, that held me in place on this earth, that gave my life meaning, people to show up for. I mean, it's such something that's so missing in so many sectors of American life today. But I grew up with that sense that life was sacred, that I belonged to this important historic movement, and that I had work to do.
And that there were other people like you, and you could, like, go to a restaurant or stop at a gas station, and you see other Mormons, and you recognize each
yeah.
other.
In the book, I talk about being a young girl and learning to sort of spot other Mormons in public, you know, the ones with six kids in tow, the ones who aren't drinking coffee, don't have cigarettes, have the BYU sticker on the car. I grew up, scholars talk about Mormonism as having a culture region that extends from really southern Canada down sort of the I-15 corridor into Southern California. And I grew up within the Mormon culture region, and I knew that we moved in a space that Mormons had inhabited and transited since the 1850s.
And that sense of kind of modesty and piety really infused your life, and the world outside of it seemed maybe a little scary.
Of course. I mean, strong demarcation between the world I lived inside, even though I attended public schools, watched television like every other normal kid on the block, was virtually indistinguishable from other, you know, fair hair, you know, other kids growing up in Southern California. I felt a world of difference. And I felt that as a Mormon, I had a special obligation to live differently. And so I describe it as being a root beer among the Cokes, right? Referring to this prohibition when I was growing up that Mormons used to emphasize more about not drinking caffeinated sodas. Now, Mormons are among the world's greatest Diet Coke addicts these days. But
what happened?
The emphasis shifted. I don't know. When I grew up, I was only root beer. I still don't think you can get a Diet Coke on campus at BYU. I grew up not. I didn't have my first caffeinated soda until I was 20. But I describe that sense of difference as being a root beer among the Cokes, right? You can't tell by looking, but there is this profound sense of difference as a Mormon girl I felt every day.
And it was a pleasant difference.
It was a powerful and meaningful difference. It gave my. I felt that my life had a sense of purpose. I was so grateful to have purpose because the world can seem fairly random. It is fairly random.
Yeah. Well, and there was a sense of a benevolent God that you could talk to.
One of the most beautiful things about growing up Mormon is that you're raised with stories that your faith tradition was founded by a young person with questions. I mean, our founding legend is Joseph Smith at 14 years old saying, I don't like my parents' churches, and going into a forest and praying and getting answers directly from God. So from the time I was a child, I was taught that if I had questions, I could ask them directly to God without mediation of grown-ups. And that my questions would be heard and answered. And that created some extremely sweet and powerful experiences for me as a Mormon girl. It gave me a great sense of my own worth as a soul, really. Yeah.
And so, as you write about, there are so many stories that Mormons grow up with that are very powerful and give you that sense of safety and belonging.
Right.
And then there are other stories that you discover when you're older that kind of throw a wedge into the whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, here's the shocker. Mormon people come of age, like people in every other faith tradition. And ours has been a community that has heavily emphasized orthodoxy. We have not developed formal you know, divisions. Like if you're a Jew and you grew up Orthodox, maybe later in life you become Reform if Orthodox doesn't work out. But Mormons, because we are such a young religious movement, have had a very strong inside and outside. So in the book, I talk a lot about coming of age in the faith, becoming a feminist at Brigham Young University of all places, becoming a political progressive in a faith tradition that is so deeply, has been in the 20th century, so deeply conservative. And where do you go with that? I mean, you know, a lot of Mormons get pushed out of the more Orthodox sectors of the faith community, but that's changing now. More and more progressive Mormons are claiming a critical but loving place in this tradition.
Because they don't want to leave the church.
We don't want to leave the church, and we don't want to leave the movement. And, you know, there's the LDS Church, which
LDS,
is...
Latter-day Saints.
That's corporate Mormonism. It's organized Mormonism. But then there's something even bigger called the Mormon Movement, which is... this 14 branches, global, messy, ongoing, open-ended story that we belong to, whether we're Orthodox believers or not. And that's hard to leave behind.
Part of the story is the racism within the Mormon church.
Right. I mean, I grew up, it wasn't until I was 7 years old that black men were allowed to hold our lay priesthood, to serve as lay officials in Mormon congregations. Other men of color had been allowed to serve, you know, from the church's inceptions. But I was raised, and I was raised with stories, you know, drawn from the Bible, familiar to anyone who's grown up in American Christianity, Cain and Ham, that would legitimate that racism and naturalize it. I was raised not to see it and not to criticize it. But as an adult, coming to terms with that racism among Mormonism's many messy legacies, that's an important part of faith maturation, comes up in the book.
Another part of it, which you were even more closely involved with, was the very strong anti-gay and anti-gay marriage part of Mormonism, which really, I mean, they come across in the whole Proposition 8 struggle as a kind of fundraising and lobbying group for the Republicans.
I stopped going to church in the early 2000s because it was very painful. The church was ramping up its formal involvement in anti-gay marriage politics across the West. Members were being asked to donate as early as the late 90s to anti-same-sex marriage campaigns in Alaska, in Hawaii, and California, and it brought me to tears. I couldn't go to church without crying because I saw the church committing itself to this political agenda that broke up families. Gay families, and it broke my heart. That wasn't part of the Mormonism I loved. And when I came back because I wanted to raise my girls in a Mormon community. I wanted them to understand this powerful movement that had so shaped me and given me this strong sense of purpose and work and, you know, identity. That was the year the church committed to Proposition 8 in California. And, you know, members gave literally tens of thousands of dollars per family.
They were asked to give $25,000 per family.
Families that were able to were asked to make huge financial commitments. And those who were not able to were asked to donate 8 to 12 hours a week. And, you know, Mormon people know how to mobilize. We've been doing it since the 19th century. We are highly organized. We know how to take care of each other. And we know how to work when we're asked to work. And I've done labor organizing, feminist organizing, anti-racism. I've never seen people mobilize like I saw Mormons mobilize to back Proposition 8 in California in 2008. And I understood, but it broke my heart.
Now, you did some kind of personal protest actions at that time.
I was active in the No on 8 campaign, and I spoke as a faithful Mormon wherever I could, you know, to raise a voice of conscience and a voice of hope that Mormon values could be used for something other than fighting the civil equality of our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters and the protection of their families. But the book recounts some pretty personal, you know, dimensions of this struggle too. Lots of anti-Mormonism cropping up in the No on 8 campaign, which one just sort of gracefully abided, but also going to church meetings and seeing, you know, stacks of canvassing materials in the lobbies, in churches. And, you know, there's a scene in the book where I talk about, you know, taking a pack of canvassing materials and shoving them in my diaper bag.
I know, I love that.
Throwing
them down the storm drain.
I did. I shoved them in a storm drain. I mean, you know, I know how hard it is to canvass and go door to door. I've done that political work, and I know the hours of Mormon labor that went. And I'm not proud of destroying someone else's hard work, but man, that was a painful time.
Yeah.
That was so painful.
Oh. What does that look like now? Because, I mean, I don't know about Mormon circles, but even in hardcore Christian circles, young people don't really seem to care that much about the whole gay issue, whereas their parents and grandparents can still be kind of rabid about it.
I cannot believe the change we've seen in American society since 5 years ago. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
And you are right. There is a generational divide on this issue, and that divide also holds among Mormon people as well. Retention of young Mormons is an issue. And young Mormon people are raised in a world where gay people are not expected to be closeted, are not expected to marry someone straight or pray the gay away, where they see gay people raising families. The church has been in a fascinating position, having committed itself so expensively to the cause of fighting gay marriage. The legalization of gay civil marriage in Utah late last year, just in December, this Christmas present that came. Utah became the 17th state where gay marriage, no one predicted that. No, it was like if Mississippi became the 17th state that allowed black people to vote. I mean, it was unbelievable when we saw hundreds and hundreds of gay couples, the majority of them Mormon, right? People who had met their beloveds at Mormon church camps, who had been living in the shadows, coming out to have their families affirmed in public. And you know, this just hits so close to home. And the church right now has big decisions to make for itself about how it will invest in this cause going forward and how it will regard so many of its own people who are gay and lesbian and so many of its families who have gay and lesbian members. I mean, look, when you have families with five kids, there's a gay kid in there.
Yeah, I think it's 1 in 25.
Right.
Is the general.
You know, everyone's got a gay cousin. Everyone. And, you know, are we going to hold on to our people? Is the Mormon movement going to... There have always been gay and lesbian Mormons. Are we going to make a home for them in the 21st century?
Right. And so that's the struggle right now.
Right.
And we pretty much know how it's going to come out.
Well, you know, we've seen... I just think we've seen remarkable times.
At the same time, I mean, it was only 2008 that the Mormon, you know, the organized group that you were talking about, put $41 million.
Right.
Into this anti-gay marriage cause. And as you say, you know, what could that money
have done? Right. Exactly.
We're talking to Joanna Brooks about her book, The Book of Mormon Girl, A Memoir of an American Faith. Now, there's another part of this story. You went to college in, I guess, the early 1990s.
Right.
And you had a wonderful teacher who was talking about feminism and things like that, and you really started to find your feminist voice. And at a certain point, and there were Mormon feminists writing articles about Mormon women and the history of Mormon women, and then starting to write about some abuses that were happening, they got excommunicated, and there was a declaration against feminist intellectuals and gays, all of them enemies.
Yes. Those were difficult times, and I'm really happy to say that Mormon feminism has rebounded in full and is stronger than ever today. You can find us at places like Feminist Mormon Housewives, which is a blog and a Facebook community that has literally thousands upon thousands of readers and community members. You know, there is a long but little understood tradition of pro-feminist and pro-woman thinking within Mormonism. The Mormon movement, from almost its beginnings, has taught that God is not just a man. God is a couple, male and female. And for centuries, we've drawn strength from that. Mormon women have exercised the powers to heal, the powers to lead, the powers to win revelation. But again, the rise of the corporate church in the 20th century really shut down a lot of that more mystical, expressive side of our faith. But we've held on, and we've recollected our historical memories, and we are going forward as Mormon feminists, laying claim to this powerful tradition of the broader Mormon movement.
What I think is really interesting about it, that really comes out in your book, is that so many people like you really don't want to leave the church.
Right.
There's a whole world out there that,
right,
that would gladly embrace you, but you want to stay part of it, which shows how much kind of goodness and power and beauty there still is in it, despite all the nonsense.
Right, and it's something I'll talk about tonight at my lecture. The experiences, too, of indigenous Mormons and of Mormons of color. You know, why stay in a faith that has a racist history? What has it meant to those of us who are in these Mormon minorities? Well, actually, we're not really the minorities. You know, more Mormons live outside the United States than in. More Mormons speak Spanish than English. You know, like, there are so many, you know, progressive Mormons, Mormons of color, whose voices aren't heard through the hierarchy. But more and more of us are stepping forward to tell our stories and say, this faith matters to us. And it goes back to that tradition in Mormonism of personal experience that we talked about, of Joseph Smith being the young questioner, going into the grove and having a personal experience. Mormons are raised to have to seek those grounding personal experiences of the divine that anchor you through a lifetime of, you know, ups and downs. Faith ups and downs come to every faith life. And, you know, when we have these foundational experiences of children, we're encouraged to have direct contact with God, and we experience God powerfully in a Mormon context. We want to come back to that context. That stays our primary language for speaking about the divine.
Now, you ended up marrying a Jewish man, having two children, and how are you raising your children? First of all, you're not really allowed to do that if you're going to be an Orthodox Mormon woman, but you did. And how are, like, what is their upbringing?
I've found, you know, I try to give my kids a little privacy because they're 8 and 10, and they are going to have to sort this out for themselves. We're already putting the quarters in the therapy jar, you know, so that later when they're going to, why did you do this to us? I said, I fell in love with this really nice guy. You know, I have found tremendous support and warmth within organized Mormonism from my interfaith family. People have been nothing but warm and accepting of my husband, our children, even sort of our particular needs and ways of negotiating what it might be to be a bi-religious family. Our children are getting a full education in both faith traditions, and we expect them to make the same kind of choices we all make when we grow up about how to believe and how to practice, if at all.
And it'll be interesting. I've met children from interfaith families who kind of conflate the two in ways that are very amusing to outsiders.
And you know, and it's been fascinating that, you know, my husband's an anthropologist and I study religion for a living and write about it. So we've been very meta-narrative, for lack of a better term, with them. We've been all sorts of critical thinking and cultural comparisons. So we talk about in our family, you know, what's the Jewish version of this story? What's the Mormon version of this story? Which one do you like better? So they know how to code switch. They know how to talk around their Jewish relatives. It's fascinating to watch them negotiate like a double identity, sort of like a bilingual person would or a biracial person would. And it's just, you know, given me such faith in children's ability to make sense of complexity.
Yeah, kids are great at that.
I'm still shoving the quarters in the therapy jar, that just in case they get really rough. But, you know, a few years ago they thought that it was the hardest thing in the world to be Mormon. And now that they're in, you know, they had to go to church all the time. And now that they're in Hebrew school more intensely, having to learn another language, they think it's the hardest thing in the world to be Jewish. So I'm telling them they have to do lots of hard things and it'll make them a better person, which is kind of a Mormon attitude at root. Cross the plains, kids. It's good for you.
Right.
Pull the handcart. Who needs oxen?
Well, I have to say, there's some pretty tough women in Mormonism, as you describe.
Oh, yes. No, we, you know, the phrase that is on so many bumper stickers on cars around Santa Fe, you know, well-behaved women seldom make history. A Mormon feminist historian named Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is the author of that phrase.
Oh, okay.
You know, we include, you know, if you count all points on the orthodoxy spectrum, you know, we include everyone at this point, from Gladys Knight to Kay Kendall, who is, you know, one of the national leaders of the Center for Lesbian Rights. You know, we are a tough crowd.
Now, is there any environmental consciousness in Mormonism?
This is a wonderful area of development within Mormon culture as a whole in the last few years. You know, Mormons have a deep-seated love of place, a deep-seated connection, especially to landscape in the American West. You know, it's fascinating, actually. A detachment of Mormons marched through Santa Fe in the 1840s in the service of the U.S. government. The Mormon battalion came through and learned about canals from the Acequias in Santa Fe. And so, you know, if you go to Salt Lake City, you'll see canals and irrigation resembling the Acequias, you know. So Mormons have a deep-seated sense of responsibility and place and how to live on this land that, again, was submerged sort of in the interest of general conservative corporate American politics in the 20th century. But, you know, on the internet and in Facebook groups and in new books, more and more Mormon voices are coming forward with an assertion of testimony, as we would call it, on behalf of the environment. And you know, who's interested in that should look at the work of a scholar named George Hanley, based at BYU, who's one of our most beautiful and articulate voices on behalf of the land.
I think there's a kind of tension between a lot of religions and corporate conservative capitalism and politics that, I mean, they get pushed together in a way that has a lot of inherent tensions in them.
Right, and that's one of the things I'll be talking about tonight is, you know, how do you separate out or how do you understand, you know, the distinction between the corporate church and the Mormon movement? I mean, especially, you know, I'll spend a bit of time talking about the perspectives of indigenous people within Mormonism. You know, and throughout
Native American people.
Native American people, also Native Pacific Islanders. Mormonism has huge communities in the Pacific. Tongans, like a quarter of the population of Tonga is Mormon. Same with Samoa. You know,
just because there's so many missionaries that go out every year.
Well, you know, there were some, I'll talk about tonight, there's some fascinating historical alliances that developed between, you know, Mormon missionaries and indigenous communities in the Pacific, some alignments of traditional indigenous beliefs and Mormon teachings, for example, about the relationship between the living and the dead. But also, you know, Mormonism came into indigenous communities and sort of differentiated itself from other branches of missionary Protestantism. The Book of Mormon says that indigenous people have a sacred role in history, and so Mormon missionaries brought that teaching. They never said to indigenous people, you have to stop being indigenous to be Mormon. They said, you know, being indigenous is an expression of is a sacred expression. And so, you know, we find huge conversion rates and indigenous peoples adapting Mormonism to their own purposes and needs in the early 20th century. But, you know, there are ways in which the corporate church has also worked against the interests of indigenous peoples, how so many church leaders have been executives of multinational corporations that have behaved exploitatively. So there's this tension, again, between the corporate church and the Mormon movement. And I'll be trying tonight to sort of share with everyone some voices emerging from Mormon indigenous scholars, Pacifica peoples, and Native American peoples who are fighting back and trying to, not fighting back, but speaking back, you know, speaking from this experience of I've felt a powerful connection to this faith tradition, and I reject, on the basis of my faith, its corporate expressions.
Very interesting. So when you talk about globalized and decolonized,
right,
what do you mean by decolonized?
Well, decolonization is a term that is used by indigenous thinkers to describe an event and a process. The event of pushing off any kind of colonial domination and the process of removing the residuals of that domination from your mind and from your community. So to decolonize Mormonism means to rethink the whole Mormon story from the point of view of its indigenous believers. You know, what has this faith meant to indigenous peoples around the world, in Mexico, in, you know, North America, in the Pacific? Why has it mattered? What purposes have they put it to nourish and strengthen their own communities? And, you know, what would it look like if the priorities of the faith tradition shifted away from protecting the bureaucratic interests of the Salt Lake City headquartered church and towards advancing the well-being of Mormon peoples around the globe?
Now, you, as a person who grew up in Southern California in the Mormon church and basically a little white girl.
That's right.
With all your other little white girl friends.
Exactly.
If you were to go to Samoa and meet Mormons, would you have that same certain something in common?
Absolutely. There's a marvelous transnational sense of kinship Mormon people share. You know, it's important to note that, like any kinship relationship, there's tension there as well. And white Mormons have not done a good job acknowledging the ways in which the church privileges our forms of Mormonism and sometimes criticizes or, you know, stigmatizes Tongan expressions of Mormonism. There's longstanding tensions over, you know, whose version of Mormonism is acceptable. And the white people have won. So we'd like to make more space and acknowledge all of the different ways of being a Mormon and, you know, retell the story from many different perspectives, not just the little white girls growing up in the Mormon culture region.
And all of this is satirized in a relatively loving way by the musical The Book of Mormon.
Yes.
By Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who did South Park, and it's
right.
About two Mormon missionaries who go to Uganda.
Yes, exactly. That was, Mormons have flocked, well, especially Mormons like me, who are willing to be more critical about the faith, have flocked to see the musical. And, you know, for the most part, it's loving, and it, you know, it welcomes Mormon earnestness. It champions that sense of purpose that I felt as a little girl. You know, it reminds me of, there's a wonderful South Park episode all about the Mormons that concludes with, you know, the Mormon kid and the story being said, well, you know, what if this is all just bunk and it's all made up? Your whole faith is, you know, not credible. And he says, well, yeah, but I live in this amazing community that taught me to find purpose in life and take care of other people. And I love my family, and who cares? And, you know,
exactly.
I think that's what the South Park, you know, I think that's what the Book of Mormon musical says, you know, the song, I Believe, you know, what if you believe just because?
Right.
Just because.
That is a wonderful song. Now, I have to say, Mormon culinary traditions, as you describe in the book, are pretty amusing. It's like butter.
Yeah. And cream of chicken soup and sour cream and cheese.
Yep, all mixed.
Just mix those together. And we do it with potatoes here. I think y'all do it with a green chili and a tortilla, and you call it an enchilada. But we just stick it with some potatoes in the culture region. Yeah, we call it funeral potatoes. And Jell-O.
Right.
We do the Jell-O. Yeah. Yeah. Sugar. Sugar is the Mormon drug, because we don't do liquor.
I was looking at this. I was like, this is a recipe for diabetes and heart disease.
Sure thing. Yeah, we don't do liquor. We don't do most of the, you know, observant Mormons don't really do coffee or caffeinated, hot caffeine. There's a lot of closet Dr. Pepper, Diet Dr. Pepper drinkers and Diet Coke drinkers, but sugar is our thing.
In any case, the story is a fascinating one. So where are you right now with Mormonism?
I belong to a warm and loving Mormon congregation in San Diego, California. I have been serving, you know, everyone in Mormonism has a job. We don't have a paid clergy, so I've been working with young people in my congregation. I don't know if any of them know I actually wrote a book. I don't really bring up a Sunday. I just kind of show up, hey, do what I'm supposed to do. I've had a wonderful time teaching my kids the faith and continue to sort of do that. And I'm very active in Mormon progressive circles and building Mormon progressive institutions. So I am a Mormon.
Joanna Brooks' book is The Book of Mormon Girl, A Memoir of American Faith. She is chair of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at San Diego State University, and she will be speaking tonight, giving a lecture called Mormonism, Demystified, Globalized, Decolonized, at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. It's at 6:30, and it's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research, which is on the web at sarweb.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you, Mary Charlotte.